tort damages, or if we limited the amount by which healthcare providers can be held liable, that'll lower the cost of healthcare and so forth. Let me just say 90 seconds here about this argument about healthcare crisis in liability. And we're going through another cycle similar to the one that was in Fine versus Permanente. Insurance rates spike sharply higher. They will sort of go flat for a long period of time, and then they'll spike sharply. And that's what's happened recently. And basically people like the American Medical Association say the reason for this spike in insurance rates is because of higher jury verdicts, out of control tort system. The trial lawyers, on the other hand, say, no, the real reason you've got this spike is because of the change in the investment climate. And both are actually true. That is, if you had a consistent investment climate for the premium dollars that the insurance companies get, you would see a gradual rise in judgments in medical malpractice cases as standards of living rise and just sort of like everything else in society, prices go up. But where you have a very active economy where you can put your money in the stock market and make 10% return on it, insurance companies will charge less in premiums because they can take that money, put it in the stock market, and the other investments that insurance companies make, and by the time they have to actually pay out the premiums, they will have made enough money so that the lower premiums are compensated by the return on their investment. By contrast, when you have a slow economy, as we've had for the last 3 years, you can't make money in the stock market. And so to compensate for that, the insurance company raises the premium rate, not only through the normal process, where a good investment climate suppresses insurance rates, a bad investment climate makes them go higher. And the reason that it's useful to understand this is that, again, the Trial Lawyers Association will say the reason for the rise in insurance rates is because of the investment climate. It has nothing to do with us, trial lawyers. And there's some truth to that, but there's also some truth to the idea that over time, insurance rates gradually do increase, and insurance companies, like every other business, respond to supply and demand, and they look at how to make a profit and where their break-even point is and how much to charge in order to make a profit. So, again, in this particular case, in Fine versus Permanente, the court says, we don't look at the merits of this case from the standpoint of whether there is a health care crisis or not. Maybe there's not, but the legislature thought it was. We have to sort of let them make this call. Okay, second argument was that it's a violation of the Due Process Clause. Both equal protection and due process are built into the 14th Amendment. What's the gist of a Due Process Clause argument? What does the Constitution prohibit the legislature from doing? Okay. The idea of the Due Process Clause is that the legislature can't take your property away without due process. Now, there's also the Fifth Amendment, which says the government can't just seize your property except where there's just compensation. We talked about this a little bit with the cement case, Boomer versus Atlantic Cement. If the government wants the back third of your property to build a new freeway or construct a sewer line or something like that, they can condemn your property and then pay you fair compensation. In this case, they're not actually taking, what is it that they're taking away, according to Mr. Fine? Okay. Well, also the general idea, as you say, it's related, sort of the same concept as with the Equal Protection Clause argument, that before this tort reform legislation, he would have been able to get full compensation. After this legislation, they cap his non-economic damages at $250. So they've taken away through this, statute that's passed. MICRA says we're taking away everything above $250. Isn't that taking away a property right? And doesn't he deserve due process? That's his claim. What's the court's answer to that argument? But I thought the Due Process Clause says you can't take away people's property rights unless you follow due process of law. Why isn't this taking away a property right that requires the due process of law? Mr. Redman?
Because the court says that there is no constitutional property right given to the payment of future damages.
Okay. The notion is that the tort liability rules are not some sort of property right that I enjoy. When the legislature either creates a cause of action, the legislature could say, you have a cause of action for, people making loud noises at one time, for example, there was a cause of action for alienation of affections. Essentially, you done stole my woman. The informal title of that cause of action. And at one time you could file a lawsuit saying, you alienated the affections of my beloved and people recovered damages for that sort of thing. Obviously, we reached a point as a society where we said, we don't think that's a basis for giving one person compensation from another. But we could change our minds about that. So the legislature can abolish or create causes of action depending upon what the legislature thinks is the right way to balance the interests of people. Again, we could abolish a cause of action for injury on the highway. We could say if you travel on the highway, buy your own insurance, but don't plan on suing anybody because if you get injured on the highway, your responsibility to try to avoid. That wouldn't be a very bright thing to do. But again, the point constitutionally here is that no one has a vested interest in any given set of rules. We could change the rules about causation. Again, if the concurrence in Helling versus Carey decided there's going to be strict liability for doctors whose patients have unfortunate outcomes, the doctors could say, hey, you've taken away my right to practice medicine. But the answer the court would give would be the same one they give here, which is the creation or destruction of tort remedies is up to the legislature. And when they change the rules, they change the rules. Okay, third argument Mr. Fine had as to why this was unconstitutional. Yeah, the right to trial by jury. And, hum a few bars of that for me here. What's the What's the idea there? Yeah. Yeah, that's exactly right, that instead of the jury determining how much he gets, the judge determines how much he gets because, well, the jury makes their assessment, but then the judge chops it down. So is that a violation of his right to trial by jury? Why not? Suppose the legislature had changed the rules such that the jury was invited to make a ruling on whether the plaintiff or the defendant had better dressed lawyers. But the judge determined how much compensation the plaintiff received. Would that satisfy the you had a jury, Mr. Fine. Would that satisfy the constitutional right to trial by jury? No, doesn't that, I mean, there would be a point at which the jury had been so far removed from any substantive involvement in the outcome that that we would say there's no longer a right to trial by jury. On the other hand, could you say that a rule that prohibits hearsay deprives the person to a right by trial by jury? The jury wanted to listen to that hearsay testimony or that irrelevant, you know, speculation. The judge excluded it under the rules of evidence. Does that deprive the parties of a right to trial by jury? No. So it's hard to get a feel for exactly what this right to trial by jury means. The arguments at either extreme are absurd. That either the right to trial by jury means nothing except the appearance, the pomp and circumstance of having 12 people and they get, you know, they sit in a box and they listen and so forth, but they have virtually nothing to say about the outcome. On the other extreme, that the jury can't be guided in any way by the substantive law or by the rules of procedure. The jury gets to do, you know, like an ill-behaved two-year-old can do whatever it wants, that that would be absurd as well. But where in the middle you still have a right to trial by jury, but the jury's imposing the rules set up by the legislature, nobody exactly knows where that line is. But this one doesn't offend that rule. As I mentioned in the notes, exactly the opposite conclusion was reached in a case in Washington where there was a tort reform provision that limited the amount of pain and suffering damages to a certain multiple of the economic damages. And the court in that case decided it was a violation of the state constitutional provision that said the right to trial by jury shall remain inviolate, a somewhat stronger statement than the right to trial, you have a right to trial by jury. So, again, some courts will, as we'll see later on in Chapter 7, some courts will take these constitutional provisions, apply them, find the tort reform statute to be over the line. Other courts will look at the tort reform legislation and say, hey, that's what legislatures get to do. It's our job to enforce it. Well, sort of along those lines, the next case, Schoenberger versus Roberts, isn't that our next case here? Good. In the next case of Schoenberger versus Roberts, we have another instance where the legislature passed a statute, but now it's the job of the courts to figure out what to do with that statute. And we've shifted topic here in Schoenberger versus Roberts to this whole issue about collateral sources. So I want to make sure you get the picture with respect to what the treatment of collateral sources is. Can somebody tell me about Schoenberger? Ms. DeNamer. Okay, so just so we understand the dynamics here, workers' comp has already paid the plaintiff a bunch of money, and the defendant says, in effect, well, ultimately, actually, we're not exactly sure what the defendant is saying, but what the court has to figure out is, when we figure out how much the defendant owes the plaintiff, do we pay any attention to the fact that the plaintiff's already been compensated, or do we pretend that never happened? And let's go back before the statute to the pre-statute era, and when this issue first came up in a court proceeding, when the common law grappled with this issue, what was the original approach to this, the so-called collateral source rule? Before the statute, what was the general understanding? In short, what are we supposed to do with the information? This is before the statute. What are we supposed to do with the information about workers' comp? Pardon? Yeah, ignore it. Don't tell the jury about the fact that he's got this workers' comp award. Now, if our goal, going back to kind of the baseline principles of Chapter 3, if our goal for purposes of compensatory damages is to sort of restore the plaintiff to the position where they would have been but for the defendant's negligence or breach of duty, to the extent that, you know, the defendant emptied the plaintiff's tank or, you know, brought it down, but now somebody else has brought it part of the way up, what's the rationale for saying, oh, but don't pay any attention to that, charge the defendant the same amount as if he hadn't received any compensation at all? How does that square with the idea that we're trying to kind of refill the plaintiff's tank to the level where it would have been but for this injury? What was the rationale for that? Mr. Middleton. Well, it might say, in effect, We're so intent on getting the defendant, you know, we don't want the defendant to slither out from under this, you know, obligation. We want to make sure they get their 40 lashes here. That might be one idea. What else justifies the refusal to take into account the fact that the plaintiff's already been compensated, in particular with respect to workers' comp? Mr. Gallagher. Yes, this idea of what is called subrogation. Many insurance plans and most workers' comp plans by statute say you're entitled when you get injured on the job, or an insurance plan that says, you know, you buy health insurance of some kind through Blue Cross or some private plan or any other form of health insurance, it says, in effect, you get injured, we will pay for your medical care. But if you read the fine print of your contract, lo and behold, buried there in all the boilerplate fine print of your contract, it says receipt of compensation from third parties or something like that. And it says, if you get compensated for the injuries for which we have provided medical care, and you get compensated for that medical care, we want our money back. And in particular, with respect to workers' comp, workers' comp is very alert to the possibility that as they're paying out these workers' comp benefits, there may be a tort suit against some third party, a driver who injured the plaintiff, a defective piece of machinery that fell on the, you know, or injured the worker while they were on the job. And if there is a tort suit, they get dibs on the money they have paid out. So it isn't just a case where, in fact, it's not a case where we're overcompensating the plaintiff so we can be mean to the defendant and make sure we get every last, squeeze every last dollar out of them. But in fact, if we didn't do this, the plaintiff would wind up getting undercompensated and the defendant would wind up not paying their fair share. And again, who's paid the premiums? Who's responsible for this compensation in the first place? It's not the defendant whose generosity has made this possible. If the plaintiff, for example, went out and purchased their own health insurance, or they get it through work, and you know the money the employer pays into health insurance in some way comes out of the employee's pocket, then it doesn't seem fair that the defendant whose negligence caused this in the first place should get a windfall and the plaintiff should go without. So that's the logic of the original collateral source rule. It, in effect, says pay no attention to that man behind the curtain. Ignore the fact that the plaintiff has gotten money from workers' comp, health insurance, a generous relative, a disability plan, what have you. Okay, so that's kind of the background. Along comes this statute, and what does the statute say? Okay, so the statute, but how does the statute affect the trial of the case? Mr. Schoenberger offers his evidence about the defendant's negligence. He offers evidence about the money he spent for health care. Then what does the statute do? How does the statute change things from the original collateral source rule? Okay, but that was true before the statute. How has the statute changed things? Okay, that's the court's opinion here, where the court is saying, in effect, we don't think it would be right to do what the statute tells us to do because there is this potential that it'll get deducted twice. So, but again, we want to identify what it is, how the statute has changed the landscape. Mr. Trujillo? Well, workers' comp, again, has paid his medical bills. And under the old rule, we would ignore that. Is that true under the statute? No, the statute says, do pay attention to that man behind the curtain. The defendant may introduce evidence that the plaintiff has already been compensated for part of this injury. And in this case, the trial court did what? The trial court refused to do that. The trial court said, I'm not going to let that evidence in. And then the defendant appeals, and the defendant says, look, the statute tells you, hello, trial judge, it says the defendant may introduce this evidence. And the trial court made a mistake by refusing to admit the evidence. But now we come to the language you were talking about earlier, where the court says, look at what could happen, could easily happen, if you allow this evidence to come in. What's likely to happen? The jury will reduce the amount of damages they award to the plaintiff, thinking that, oh, we don't have to have the defendant pay for this. The plaintiff's already gotten this money. Now, in theory, the jury is being told not to do that. But the court is worried that jurors won't understand what's going on, will double in effect. They'll reduce it, not realizing they're not supposed to reduce it. And how does the court answer the argument that they've been issued an order by the legislature? Okay. Okay, they say, they refer to this fact as it leads to a sort of a legal absurdity, what they refer to as a sort of a stop sign. You know, normally when the legislature says do this, we do it. But in this case, it leads to such an absurd result, we can't believe they really meant to do that. There's sort of a clerical error here, according to the Supreme Court. Now, not everybody on the court is convinced of that. There is a dissenting opinion. What's the point of the dissenting opinion? Okay, but the dissenting opinion disagrees with the court as to whether or not it was a mistake to leave this evidence out. So what does the dissent want us to do? What's that? Okay, so the dissent thinks there was a mistake. The dissent thinks that the trial judge should have admitted this evidence. Why? Because that's what the legislature told us to do, says the dissent. Ours is not to reason why. Again, the question about how a judge interprets stuff coming from the legislature, the majority says, well, we're happy to follow the legislature whenever the legislature does things that make sense to us. But when the legislature is doing something we really don't understand, no rational person, it seems to them, could have wanted to do that, then we think it's our job to do the right thing rather than literal instruction from the legislature. Let's just think for a moment, why might a legislator, if the intent of the legislature is we don't want the plaintiff's compensation to be reduced, we want the jury to award full compensation, not reducing the plaintiff's compensation by the amount of the workers' comp benefit, but we still want the jury to hear about the fact that the plaintiff's already been compensated. Why? Why, if you were a legislator, without wanting to see the plaintiff's compensation reduced, why might you want the jury to learn about the fact that the plaintiff's already been compensated? Ms. McGrain? If I'm a defendant, I'd love to have the evidence about workers' comp brought in because it sort of it's a little reality check here. Plaintiff's lawyer's talking about, you know, these big sums of money that the plaintiff needs to get, and in effect, I as the defendant's lawyer can say, well, you know, there's a system called workers' compensation. You know how much compensation the plaintiff got here? It's like $10,000. Here's the plaintiff who wants $120,000. Something wrong. So it sort of sets the level of expectation by pointing to how much this state-run system thinks is compensation. Now, of course, workers' compensation is only wage loss and medical expenses. There's no pain and suffering. And the way that workers' comp sets these awards is in a much more bureaucratically stingy fashion. There's another reason, if I'm a defendant, I would love to have the jury aware of the amount of compensation the plaintiff's gotten from workers' comp, even if it didn't reduce the award. Even if I knew 100% of the time the jury was going to get it right and would never reduce the amount of the award. Mr. Griffin? Not officially, Ms. Keene. But if I'm the defendant who drove into the, you know, I negligently struck the plaintiff's automobile while the plaintiff was on the job, whether the plaintiff's on the job or not on the job doesn't really affect my liability. But how would the fact that the plaintiff's received workers' compensation help me as a defendant, Mr. Stubbs? If the plaintiff has proven a case of negligence, then the plaintiff gets to recover. But if the jury's struggling, was this really negligent by the defendant? I don't know. Did it really cause this thing? If my fear as a juror is that if we don't compensate the plaintiff, they're going to be out with a tin cup on the street, I may kind of resolve any doubts in favor of compensation. By contrast, if I find out the plaintiff's already gotten, you know, wage loss and medical expenses paid for, then I'm not a charity here as a juror. Sure, if the plaintiff proves their liability case, they're entitled to a recovery, but I'm not the only way that the plaintiff's going to be able to get along. So it in effect removes from the plaintiff's hands the sort of weapon of saying, in effect, you, the jury, are the means by which the plaintiff will be able to live a decent life. I'd love to have that as a defendant. And whether for that reason or for some other reason, the legislature thought it was fair that the jury be told about the existence of workers' compensation, even though they might very well, and it's hard to tell whether the legislature thought about this seriously. This is where the majority differs from, or maybe it is, it's certainly the thing that the majority is most concerned about is we're not convinced the legislature realized the extent to which you're likely to get undesired results. We know the system. We know the way it works. We know the way juries work. A lot of the time, they're going to mess it up. So if you didn't want it messed up, you shouldn't be introducing this evidence. By contrast, there may be some thought that, well, the defendant's entitled to the benefit of this information because otherwise the jury may make a mistake in the direction of thinking, we're the only way this family is going to be able to pay their bills and stay in their house and afford to do the things that they otherwise need to do. Mr. Gallagher. Oh, yeah. I mean, the defendant's just interested in paying as little as possible, as the plaintiff's interest is in getting as much as possible. They're sort of symmetrically interested there. And the question is, what should we do with respect to these questions? Should we introduce this evidence at the risk that the jury's going to get it wrong? Or should we keep the evidence out at the risk of having the jury be sort of under a false impression about the consequences of their decision? Now, there are actually some reform statutes. There's a provision of MICRA we didn't talk about, in addition to periodic payments. But there's another issue we didn't talk about, which is MICRA actually changed the rule to say not only do you let this evidence in, you actually reduce the award the doctor has to pay by any other form of compensation, and at the same time, they legislatively extinguish the right to subrogation. So the microstatute says, we want to reduce the amount the doctors have to pay, again, because our goal is to make liability insurance affordable, malpractice insurance affordable, so we can keep doctors practicing medicine instead of bailing out and doing something else with their talents. And the way we're going to do that is essentially to shift the burden from them to things like workers' comp or disability plans or private health insurance. Again, if that's what the legislature wants to do, they can do that. But it does seem, you know, again, like a public policy question of whether the defendant who causes the injury, at least so the jury's verdict would suggest, whether the defendant who causes that injury should have the burden on them lightened by the compensation the plaintiff has secured from some other source. Bottom line here is that the collateral source rule, again, would ordinarily exclude this evidence. At the same time, from the plaintiff's standpoint, it means a lower recovery because of this obligation, the subrogation problem. If you work with Ms. Sharp, who worked in a plaintiff's personal injury practice, what your clients are interested in is not the theoretical recovery, how much theoretically does the jury award, but the client is interested in how much new money is there. What, after all the other stuff has been paid, actually winds up in my pocket? How many $100 bills get peeled off and, you know, paid out to me at the pay window? And if, for example, you have a claim in which the defendant offers to say, look, I'll settle this case for $100,000, well, what happens if there's a substantial workers' comp lien? What happens if workers' comp has already paid $15,000? Well, that only leaves $85,000 that's net. But now, let's see, the lawyer's getting a third of the full amount because the lawyer had to pay for, you know. So the lawyer's taking 33 1/3 off of this. And we've got expenses to pay for, so the amount of new money that actually winds up in the plaintiff's pocket turns out to be something like $35,000, let's say. Of a $100,000 settlement that the defendant offers, the amount of new money that winds up in the plaintiff's pocket is only 33, or something like that. Typical kind of case, and it can be worse. If you have a very substantial workers' comp lien and a relatively modest case against, you know, you're kind of pushing the envelope against the defendant. The defendant's willing to put some money on the table to settle this thing, but not very much, because after all, you've got a pretty weak liability case. The defendant's inclination would be, you know, I'm pretty sure I can beat this at trial. To spare myself of the expense and the risk of that, I'm willing to put some money on the table. But if workers' comp is there with their tin cup saying, give me back the money I paid on this, you can get squeezed to the point where there's no new money, and the plaintiff saying, in effect, well, what do I get out of this? Nothing. Well, then let's take the case to trial. And a case that might otherwise settle gets squeezed by the fact that there's nothing left after the... Now, one of the issues is, can workers' comp accept a reduction in their claim? Could I make a deal where the plaintiff gets less than what they want, but workers' comp gets less than what they want? Or does workers' comp always get paid in full, even though the claim has been compromised and the plaintiff's getting less than what they would get if they took it all the way to trial. Under the old regime in Washington, you could compromise these liens. Under the new regime, you can't. At least that's my understanding. Okay. They'll still... Yeah. And that makes a lot of sense, except if you work at workers' comp and somebody comes to you and says, hey, you know, I've got $1 million claim here, but we're settling it for $100,000. Why don't you take 10% of your lien? Well, how do I know it's $1 million claim? There's the people who work at workers' comp, unless they're tracking this case, putting in the kind of time that the plaintiffs and the defense lawyers are... Anyway, so all of these, I don't want to get you too bogged down on all the details, but as they say, the devil is in the details. In a lot of these cases, the dynamics of getting the workers' comp system or other liens taken care of so you can get some new money into the case, again, you wind up persuading the client, oh, good news, sort of like the Geico ads, you know, I got good news, you know, the defendant's offered to pay $100,000 in this case. Oh, does that mean I get, you know, $100,000? Well, no, as a matter of fact, but I got a great deal on my car insurance, you know. Again, having the system work out in a way that is fair to everybody is easier said than done. Okay, questions about the collateral source rule? Yes, Mr. Whitfield.
I've got a question about the workers' comp. So you pay back workers' comp, right?
Right.
Now,
that's a good question, actually. And I don't know when workers' comp, typically by the time the case is settled, your injuries have been, you know, have stabilized. You're either back at work or workers' comp has made an award to you of some sort of partial disability or permanent disability, or there's some sort of final fixed solution. But I could imagine certainly a case in which there was an ongoing deal, but the parties were ready to settle early on. A defendant who's very aggressive in terms of settlement, who wants to get these claims settled before workers' comp is actually resolved. What happens if you do get this compensation? Does essentially workers' comp say, oh, well, then you've had your stuff taken care of. We're no longer going to pay on this. Or is there some way you can continue to get workers' comp? The way it works in a past injury case is that workers' comp actually has a lien. That is, they have a legal right to it, and it basically attaches to the lawyer's, you know, when a lawyer pays the money out, they can't say, oh, well, go track down this client over here and make them pay. The money that comes into the lawyer's office is essentially earmarked for the state, so it never touches the plaintiff's pocket. Whereas another kind of settlement might. Anyway, I don't know what would happen if you had a case where there was an ongoing workers' comp lien, but in most cases, that's all in the past. We're talking about something that happened 2-3 years ago. By that time, workers' comp has evaluated the case and settled it, and the amount of the lien is fixed. Ms. Keene. Yes. Yes, that's a very good way to summarize it. And the way in which this would come up in the exam, occasionally, as we'll see in Chapter 6, I start nibbling away at this idea about settlement, and I will occasionally pose a question, which is, this party is offering to settle for this much, what would you advise? And there are problems that come up in Chapter 6 about different ways of handling settlements, such that you would have to incorporate what you know about the collateral source rule and about the rules for settlement in order to give them good advice. I'm sorry, say that again? Yes. Yes. The only exception would be where workers' comp agrees to compromise the lien by saying, yeah, we we theoretically would be entitled to $20,000, but we recognize that you're settling this case, so we'll reduce our lien to $8,000. But the lien is in the amount they put into it. Just as you may know that when you take your car to the auto repair shop, they have a lien, a mechanics lien, as it's called, so that before you can get your car back, they can say, pay the work that we put into it. Okay, so we've done collateral sources. What's the next thing I've got to... Is it... or have we done Botta versus... Is it Botta versus Brunner is our next assignment here. Okay, let's look at Botta versus Brunner here. Can somebody... It's not really a case as such. Maybe I can just sort of set the problem up and we can talk about it. Essentially, Botta versus Brunner recites an old tort king, Melvin Belli, from several generations ago, actually, but one of the first flashy, successful, big-time plaintiff's lawyers. And he went around the country giving talks to people in which he said, look, if you really want to get top dollar in your personal injury cases, he's speaking to his fellow plaintiff's lawyers, if you want to get top dollar, don't just ask people for a big, huge sum of money. That's going to scare them. Break it down into what it really looks like on a day-to-day basis. And then so they began to dub this the per diem argument, per day. So... what you do is you take an example. Let's say a person had their arm broken in an intersection collision. The surgery required putting a steel pin. By the way, I read something in the newspaper today about an operation where the doctor put a screwdriver instead of a pin, and the patient was unhappy about that for some strange reason. Okay, but you go to... You get your arm broken in the intersection. There's a pin that's taken or put in there. Your arm's never quite the same. It's painful. Your range of motion's limited, et cetera, et cetera. What Melvin Belli says is, don't ask the jury for $75,000. Ask the jury to give your client $2 a day. And you can maybe $5, maybe $20 a day, depending on how serious the injury is. And then you describe the ways in which this injury affects, you know, you wake up in the morning. In fact, you used to wake up at 7, now you wake up at 5:30 in the morning because you find you've rolled over on this arm and now it really hurts and you can't get back to sleep. Okay, so you get out of bed and you take a couple of aspirin for the pain and then you get dressed and you got to, you know, change the way you get dressed because you can't quite lift this arm the way you used. You just go through a day in the life of the plaintiff and say, would $20 be too much for the kind of inconvenience that the plaintiff has suffered? That doesn't sound like, well, if you take $20 per day, and we run it out through the next, you know, 40 years or whatever it is the plaintiff is expected to live, that's how much I'm asking you for. And Belli reports how effective this is in getting juries to give big awards. Now the issue is, can he do that? Should he be able, if you were the Supreme Court of New Jersey or any other court setting the rules of engagement, can you ask the jury to do this? Ms. Reed, did I see you shaking your head there? Why not? But notice that they will let Melvin Belli or whoever ask the jury for $100 gazillion. There's no limit on, which of course would be speculative too, But it's this per diem business that the court finds particularly objectionable. It gives the appearance of being scientific, but of course it isn't scientific. But on the other hand, we are just working the numbers here. Numbers is numbers. Why is there some, Mr. Lobach? Okay. Mr. Trujillo? But isn't this method of analysis more helpful? If I ask the jury for $535,000, that's sort of an unreal sum of money. But when I say, look, this is how the pin in the guy's arm, this is how it affects his life. He has trouble getting dressed. He wakes up a little early. He goes to bowl and then realizes that the other guys on his bowling team are sort of like, oh, God, he showed up tonight. I suppose we'll have to put him in here. If this is the effect that it's had, why shouldn't we try to kind of get a bite-sized snapshot of reality here. Mr. Glover. So you like the argument. Okay, but I want to hear somebody who doesn't like the argument. Mr. Ortiz. And if we were talking about economics, if we're talking about Mrs. O'Shea's wage loss, then we do figure out we hire the economist. But if we're talking about pain and suffering, but there are no experts in this. Is it better that we ask the jury for a flat sum of money, $800,000 or $120,000, $7 million, or is it better that we break it down into a day in the life of Melvin Bell? I think we're doing a much better job, certainly, of landing some pretty big fish. And the question is whether he's onto something. He's getting closer to the truth, and that's why juries are making a big award. Or is he getting farther away from the truth by giving you this day-to-day snapshot? Ms. Sharp? But doesn't the attorney act like the expert when the attorney says the fair award in this case would be $1 million, $1 billion? Or on flex pay. Yeah, don't look at this big dollar amount. If you do it on flex pay here, we can break it up into six easy payments here. Yeah, but that's deceitful.
Well, it seems that it's sort of charming the jury.
Such as we are, we do try a little bit of charm. Yeah, Ms. Peterson, I think. Yeah. Well, and then, of course, the same thing would be true of $100,000. $100,000 isn't what it used to be. Some people might say that we don't have, as we would in the case of economic damages, some fixed objective reference point where we get experts to come in and help us do this. I have a theory about this, and maybe my theory is right, maybe my theory is wrong, but I have the feeling that one of the ways in which Belli's argument is effective is not only that it's sort of on a flex pay system of taking a big number and breaking it down into bite-sized chunks, but also the phenomenon that most experiences in life, in effect, have a kind of natural lessening effect over time. The economists refer to the decreasing utility of money. The first dollar you get that allows you to, you know, get shelter and food and clothing, the first $10,000 you get make a huge difference in your life. The next $10,000 have an impact, but it keeps decreasing. When you're in the Bill Gates realm, you know, you get another $1 billion, well, whoop-de-doo, you know. It doesn't affect him as much because he can't do much more with that. Now, it's sort of what one could make the argument with respect to traumatic experiences on the other end. You know, the first Super Bowl ring you get, or the first, you know, time you get named to the All-Star team, you know, it's a big deal, but the second, the third, the fourth, fifth time, it's, you know, it's nice, but it doesn't have the same impact. Could you say that with respect to such things as the pain in my elbow, or the fact that I have this disfiguring scar on my face, or there's some other condition that the defendant has imposed upon me, in the beginning, it's very traumatic. But after that, you sort of acclimate to it. It doesn't have this, life just goes on. In the same way, the good experiences sort of lose the thrill over a period of time. The first bite of that ice cream cone on a hot day, that first slurp of coffee in the morning, the first, the sucking the head off that foam of the beer, you know, at 5 o'clock. It's a marvelous experience, but, you know, three pitchers later, it's, you know, kind of flat. So, again, if I'm correct that this is part of what the court is worried about, the effectiveness in part of Belli's argument is that when you focus on a day in the life of the guy with the broken arm, or a day in the life of a person with a spinal cord injury or with a disfiguring scar in their face, you sort of get that first, you imagine to yourself, how would my life be different if I had this condition? How much would I think I would need to be compensated? And you forget the fact that the impact of this will diminish over time. Eventually, it all sort of fades into, well, that's just the way my life is. At first, it's a terrible shock. Just as, again, a good experience in the beginning. I just won the lottery, or I just, you know, became president of the United States, or I just had, you know, and in the beginning, you're just thrilled. But after a while, it's kind of, yeah, you know. I wake up on 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue, and, you know, it's the same damn thing. And if that's true, then we would make a mistake to allow the jury to act as though this initial experience, you know, this one day, is going to be like the 20,000 days which are to follow. Or maybe we wouldn't make a mistake. I'm not entirely sure. Mr. Rubio?
Well, I've got different from the lawyer asking the jury for this huge amount of money, given that it was an immediate impact on the plaintiff at that moment.
I think the idea is that when you confront people with a huge amount of money, they see it's a huge amount of money, and that there is a sort of sleight of hand here. This is what the New Jersey Supreme Court thinks. There is a sort of sleight of hand where instead of confronting people with this huge amount of money, maybe that's the amount of money the plaintiff deserves, but at least you get to see it for what it is. If instead you take this little one day at a time It's like saying, well, you know, for only pennies a day, I can get you this, whatever it is. Oh, well, if you put it that way, not quite realizing for pennies a day, well, wow, by the time I get through 5 years of that, I paid a lot of money.
Mr. Nelson. Wouldn't you be making the assumption then that as the paraplegic's life goes on, that each day they would give less and less and less to be made whole again? So after 15 years, instead of the $50 a day that it would take to make them whole, you know, or the pain and suffering, today's a pretty good day. It would only take $5 for me to say, yeah, I'd be whole again on the day.
And the reason, one counter argument the plaintiff might make to it, where the defendant says, let me set this up properly, the defendant says, this is deceptive. It's a bad argument. And the plaintiff says, fine, give me the counter argument. Hey, you know, who says closing argument is all scientific? Closing arguments, you make arguments and I'll make my argument, you make your counter argument. And the defendant says, I can't. I can't get to the jury and say, well, sure, he's miserable now, but he'll get used to it. We may believe that, but we can't say it. And so the defendant says, to be fair, you either don't let the plaintiff make that argument, or you're going to give the plaintiff this huge advantage, as Melvin Belli's bragging shows. You know, this really works. It changes the way juries make awards. Now, Melvin Belli would say the reason it works is because we get closer to the truth here. But the court winds up saying, no, I think we're getting farther away. Now, again, the notes indicates the jurisdictions are about evenly split. Some will allow it, some won't. Even if they don't allow the per diem argument, where you get to run the numbers, you can always, as a plaintiff, and it's one of the things plaintiff's lawyers do, I don't know, Ms. Sharp, if your firm ever did this, they do like a day in the life video. And so you walk around with a video camera and you watch what a day in the life is of a guy who's, you know, lost three fingers of one hand or has this disfiguring scar or has, you know, whatever it is. And you naturally have a viewer of one of these films is affected by, wow, you know, I can see what this is like. And it stimulates your compassion. Now, in the absence of being able to make the Melvin Belli day in the life, in the absence of making the per diem argument where you break it down to say, yeah, and that one day is worth X number of dollars, you can still sort of impress upon the jury that each day of the plaintiff's life has these trials and points of difficulty, and that hopefully will motivate the jury to give you a big award, even if you can't break it down to what it costs day by day. Why don't we take our 10-minute break, and we'll come back and pick up with the last of these cases here.